Hey, I'm Nate Mihalovich, and welcome to another episode of The Roundup, presented by The Lasso. I am joined here by John Frederick this week, currently leading the creator network at the car dealership Guy. You probably have heard of them from, or heard of him from X or Twitter, very big there. And John comes from a long career actually in the dealership space. First started at Koons, then went to Full Path. Now over at Car Dealership Guy, helping build out their team. He's got a super interesting story, and I'm really excited to jump into it with him. Let's get started and dive in.
Why don't we just start from the place I said, did you sharpen up your language skills?
Our finance manager got assassinated by a turban bomb in Afghanistan.
Wait, really?
Can I say that or no?
Did they actually?
It was Ahmad Karzai's cousin. He was like our finance manager, and one day he was like, "Hey, I'm gonna go like to Afghanistan. I'm a governor now." And we were like, "Good luck." And then like New York Times like headline was like he got assassinated by a turban bomb.
Whoa.
Maybe it's kind of callous. I shouldn't mention it, but
That's pretty gnarly.
like that was the sort of shit. I have a cleaner one.
So we'll start here, which is so 3, 2, 1, and then we'll go. I'll ask if you have any really crazy stories. So, okay. 3, 2, 1. So, do you have any really like crazy stories from, obviously State Department? Then there must be some good stories that you have.
Yeah, during the Syrian civil war, I exported 50 Tundras with like bulletproof sidewalls and duplicate parts and everything to Syria through some sort of contractor. I suppose we all know like who the inevitable buyer was, but it was a really big thing. I was a young guy and my general manager was like, "Dude, if you just ordered 50 Tundras and like this guy doesn't pick them up, you're like cooked." So I kind of had my neck on the line a little bit, but we did sell 50 Tundras that got exported, and you can really only export to the State Department. You can't export a new vehicle. You can't cough up the certificate of origin, the CO, to anybody but the State Department when they kind of like send people abroad. So it's like a very technical deal. But yeah, we've had a litany of wild deals like that.
Wow. So tell me about the sort of the start of your career. I know that Mr. Coons kind of handpicks you, wants you to work there. I think that's pretty neat. What do you like what where do you, what do you start? What do you where do you want to end up going?
Yeah, so they just like threw me the wolves, one of 50 salespeople on the floor at Tyson's Toyota, and it was kind of like get promoted when you're the top guy. So it was like took me 6 months to do it, and there are like the best car salesmen ever on that floor, and you're severely disadvantaged not speaking multiple languages. So like their top guy there is this guy named like Daniele Bava, who can do like he's the smartest person I've ever met. He can do like advanced math in his head. He speaks seven languages and he just like walks around the showroom and he sells 50 cars a month, just kind of like
Wow.
because he just ease of doing business. So like I think come I started in July, June or July, and then come like January, I think I got promoted to internet manager and did a stint there. And the lead volume was so big, it was really kind of an exciting job because they let you work deals too. And then after a stint there, I got to be the new car manager. And that was a wild ride there because they split the floor, and one guy, Phil Klayman, was my counterpart. He took like half the team. I took the other half. And Phil's an interesting guy. You should have him on your podcast. He was like the lead singer of like a decently successful band. I know he had a Super Bowl commercial at one point, and he's still the GSM up at one of those stores up there.
Wow.
But so Phil and I would like we were kind of like frenemies. We'd sit next to each other. We were like each other's best friend, but we only made the gross that our team made. So it was kind of like this total mind game of like making sure your guys were taking ups and his guys weren't taking yours. And I did that as long as I could. And then I got to become the used car manager. And that was really exciting because we got to carry about 350 cars in stock. And, I think we set the high watermark for units and gross for the Koons Group in one of the years. I think it was around like 2016, 2017. That was really fun. I think it was December. it might have been August, but I know we worked like a dog, and then ultimately like the GM said to us, he was like, that had more to do with like vehicle acquisition and kind of like pricing than it had to do with anything, but it was cool to kind of like, you know, hit it.
Yeah. Well, that's a really amazing story. And we've kind of, I think that you've given the 30,000 foot view. So I want to zoom in a little bit. You know, you got thrown to the wolves, you come up against some really stiff competition. How do you compete? I mean, you know, you can work nights and weekends and do all that stuff, but, and I've run sales teams, but working harder is never just like a solution. So what was the key to success for you?
Yeah, no, now I know that, but I don't think you could tell like 22-year-old version of me that. So I was like the 6-day-a-week psycho, and you know, Kuhn's or Tyson's Toyota worked off of an uplist. So it was like we had 50 people and you would sign into the uplist in the morning, and then you would then see customers in that order. And then if you have 50 people, man, like you're not going to get 50 walk-ins that day. You're going to get like 25.
Right.
So ultimately you have to be there at like 7 a.m. sign the uplist, and you have to stay late to get that second to third shot. So I did work like a psycho, and that was pretty wild. I mean, ultimately that's what got me so far. I ended up being a general sales manager of a Toyota store at a very young age. And you know, the income was what I wanted. And ultimately I wanted to run a big Toyota store. But like it, I eventually hit a wall, and that's why I'm no longer in automotive retail. Is like at 27 years old, my like brain basically like melted, and I had to tap out.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you were telling me that story earlier. It's a pretty crazy story. And if you want to tell it, then you're welcome to do that. Was it just about the hours for you? Were there mentors of yours who really gave you advice on how to be a great salesperson? What the things were that set you apart?
I was thinking about that at breakfast. How like, what's the common denominator of all my like mentors in life? And it's kind of like hardcore sales guys with receding hairlines and like stress to the gills. that's who like brought me up through the business. But I don't know. Like, yes, I learned a lot, and I was guided by guys who ran big organizations, who taught me how to buy cars, who taught me like really nuanced things about how to close deals. Great. I mean, Mr. Kuhn's is like, that's like working for a college football coach. That's a guy with like more energy than you ever could have. So just from a standpoint of like, what does it take to be successful? You just look at that guy and you're like, how can I be more like him? Yeah. That's probably where my mind was most at. And then what I was alluding to is like, I kind of was accomplishing my goals, and I was on the trajectory that I really wanted. And, you know, I had like a wild incident where at 27 years old, I had like a seizure out of nowhere, and I had been working hard, and I'd been overworking myself. And then I got like a really bad medical diagnosis, and my wife looked at me, and she was pregnant with her first child, and we pulled the ripcord, man. And we got like out of retail car business because I had like a ambiguous medical diagnosis. I was told like I probably was going to die. And then, so I like moved to Florida, like it started like knocking down the bucket list. And when I got down here, I like, by the grace of God, I met a doctor who was like, hey brother, you are actually healthy and you're good to go. And like, you're going to be fine. So I kind of like experienced that 2 years of like staring at the ceiling every night, wondering which direction you're going. And then, you know, I kind of got a new lease on life, or I got like a very lucky.
Yeah.
And then also it kind of coincided with having young children. And, but I did put me in a position living in Jacksonville, Florida at the beach. I'm like, oh, I really did throw all my eggs in one basket. Now what the hell do I do with my car background?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could have gone back into the car space, right? I mean, Florida is a big car state.
I could have gone back into the car space, but I feel like ultimately I felt as though the Kuhn's opportunity was so good and so different that that's not quite what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what I did do. There's a guy I surf with who had a call center abroad, and we were surfing and hanging out, and I got to know him, and he was saying that he was using these guys to sell direct to consumer automotive warranties. And it was kind of tough, and it was COVID, and you know, there's like a lot of litigation in that business. So he was kind of falling out of love with it. He said, what do you think I could do with it? I said, I think you could turn it into a BDC. So him and I worked together with guys in Nicaragua. And at first it was 10 guys. And I kind of door knocked a little and got him into a few stores. And him and I built it up to like 100 guys.
Wow.
And it was a real business. And we had a partner in Nicaragua, and I had to research telephonies, and because obviously the Spanish accent's very thick. It's not like a quite proximate US country.
Yeah.
So, and the product wasn't that great, but I was just perpetually coaching these people up and putting out fires. So kind of just out of nowhere, I became a vendor.
Yeah.
And I was in Vegas selling these guys a digital dealer. And I remember landing in Vegas and I got a call from the partner in Nicaragua, and he kind of was raising my rates, which is, you know, his prerogative, but that's just what happens. I had no leverage. And I landed in Vegas and I was selling the stuff, and I was still encouraged and enthusiastic about it. But I met the guys at Auto Lead Star, and they had just hired their VP of sales, who I kind of hit it off with. And, you know, they said to me, like, why don't you just do this?
Yeah.
It's like, sounds like you're like juggling to have this kind of like automotive adjacent career. Why don't you just try and sell this for us? So I made the jump and was one of like the early sales guys at Auto Lead Star that became Full Path.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. We're going to talk about that. And we're also going to obviously talk about Car Dealership Guy, because that's kind of the golden child, I'll say, of sort of the automotive space at the time, today. So let's just, I really want to go back and kind of get into, I think that the store that you were at was certainly a unique store. What were some of the things, and now you work with dealers, and you've worked with dealers now as a vendor for 3+ years, right? 4 years. What are the, and they must ask you for advice. Like, what are the things that you saw well at Koons that you felt were some of these really great best practices that you either saw and learned there, or you felt like maybe you've picked up since then, you know, with your career that you think really hit home for dealers that would be great for them to learn about? And maybe, you know, we can focus on different parts of the dealership if you want to. Maybe we can start kind of high level and then we can get a little bit more specific.
Yeah. So upon arrival, the thing I noticed immediately was the biggest opportunity was really the phones, because our employees were all international. No one of the 50 to 55 salespeople in a given moment, no one was born in America. Mm-hmm. So everybody had an accent and had a slight kind of like, had to learn a little bit about customer service in terms of, you know, how things go with the people we're serving.
Right.
So I really did a lot of phone training and dialed in on that. And what I was finding was people were not logging phone ups. This was, you know, 2012, 2013. So that's a little, you know, people still could like, telephonies weren't stepping in and logging them for you. So I was making sure that we were going behind all the phone ups and ensuring that the appointment was made. And if it wasn't made, why wasn't it made? So I'd always let the guys take a crack at answering the phone and making the appointment and keeping it really simple. Answer the questions, ask for the appointment, strategies to get the phone number. You know, if you didn't have the vehicle in stock, how do you still make the appointment despite a vehicle not being in stock? It's a very easy fix on a new car, very hard fix on a used car. But really just kind of like playing through those scenarios with the team and then always circling back to every phone up from the day before and just calling them again. I think that's the most impactful thing you can ever do is these people had the courage to call you. So just call them again the next day. And they'll say, yeah, I can come in tonight. That's always what I found. And then secondarily, the up list, you know, I'm 34, I guess, so I'm suddenly a dinosaur, but like the paper up list on the desk, on the tower, if you could just simply log everyone you interacted with every day, the salespeople on the phone and who came through the door, if the sales manager could just make that his morning routine, and I understand nowadays use your CRMs give you these logs and everything, but just really make sure nothing falls through the cracks. And then as the sales manager, the following morning, if you're the general manager, you probably don't have time, but the sales manager, it's so impactful if you just say, hey, Nate, this is John calling from Tyson's Toyota. Thanks so much for stopping by yesterday. It was really great to meet you. I understand that you had a chance to test drive with Mike. And ultimately, the Highlander wasn't the right one. What was the apprehension with you moving forward? That's like something I still say in selling ads or whatever software. I always ask people, what was your apprehension with moving forward?
Right.
And that's something I cling to. So like the blocking and tackling of dealing with people on the phone, if you can just concentrate on that skill, you can become great. Because if they're through the door, you've got, if you have no pulse, you've got a 30% chance of closing them. If they're through the door and you're decent in any way, you've got a better than 50% chance of closing them.
Right. Right. I mean, it's so interesting because when we've had a lot of different guests on this podcast, and all the things that we talk about seem to be these very simple, obvious, they're not easy, but they are sort of simple, straightforward, obvious. And I've run sales teams on the, you know, at tech company. It's sort of, it's really fun to see the common thread amongst a lot of different disciplines, that it's really about doing the steps in a certain way, making sure that you're checking off the boxes, making sure that you're following up with people and keeping, you know, your sales force organized, and having the playbooks that people can really clearly understand what they need to go do. Go ahead.
It was a good era too, Nate, because I feel like they kind of need to replicate the guys that were doing business back in 2012, because we were coming out of the recession. Everybody was just scared to death. I remember like right before I started, I think Mr. Coons had like a famous sales meeting where he showed up in like military fatigues and was like, if you're not on board, get out of here. And like, so it was, how can you make the biggest impact? How can you sell the most cars? How can you impress the manufacturer and get like preferred treatment?
Yeah.
So, you know, back in the day, you could advertise whatever price you wanted on a Toyota. Mm-hmm. And our store, like, we had a very smart general manager. He like went to Georgetown. This guy remembered VIN numbers. He was the smartest person I've ever met.
Wow.
And I mean, I that's probably the most impactful person in my professional career. But like, he's Mr. Coons and them, the whole executive team, they kind of came up with wow pricing, where we post our best price online. And then I was there as we rolled that out. And man, we like really stuck to it. And we would advertise prices that other stores would accuse of being fake. And then they'd come in and we'd get nice trades. We'd make money on used cars and financing and stuff like that. So in that post-recession era, it was about like a thin deal on the front with financing on the back end and getting good trades. So like, that's the game I learned. Mm-hmm. So kind of like the COVID era, the markups on vehicles, I don't even know if that era of business was like for me. Yeah. I think that I was like a murderer in terms of like, I'm going to make every deal. That's the business I was taught. So like, if I was in the era of like turning deals away, and so I wouldn't even know what to do with myself. But now they might need guys like me back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting to hear the, just the approach and how, how you guys thought about doing deals. Tell me a little bit about, I want to talk about taking trades, and I know that you were a used car manager there. How did you, let's talk through like valuing cars and yeah. picking which cars to stock. Obviously, if you're stocking hundreds of vehicles, that's a very, that's a lot of capital to outlay. It's a big ordeal. It's a lot of pressure. How do you make those decisions? Were you guys using data to do that? Tell us about that process.
Well, like a funny contemporaneous thing is like this point of the political cycle, you know, 4 or 5 months out of the election, or maybe like 4 months prior to this, all the politicians would show up and try to discreetly trade their import vehicles for domestic vehicles. So like, I would always get calls. I mean, high profile people, buddy, like vice presidents of the United States and stuff would trade out their Lexus, and they would all want us to go find them Cadillacs. And like, so we were known, maybe it was because my boss was like, had Georgetown connections, and we were just the closest thing to Great Falls. But like, we would always get the discreet call of, hey, this is so-and-so, and I need a Cadillac. And we're like, well, can I get your Lexus? He goes, yeah, you can have my Lexus. I don't care. And it was like, so, you know, that was really funny to see. But yeah, man, finding vehicles to stock 350 cars in Tyson's Corner, we would try to buy out of the service lane. It was pretty tough. You know, we almost saw it as like a punishment to the salespeople. That's how like archaic we were. You know, if you were late to two meetings, you had to be at the service lane Friday at 7 a.m. or something like that. And you couldn't leave until you got three test drives. So it was, we were operating this thing like high school detention almost. And then we were looking, you know, the general manager was world's best car buyer. And he would, you know, he would attend Manheim online. And then only he could really do that. And then towards the end of my career there, he kind of like started relinquishing it to me. And we had an all-time automotive wholesaler there named George O'Connor, who really taught me the pre-owned business. And so George was our pre-owned director at one point. So like between our general manager, George, and through the tailing part of my career, they, those guys imparted enough knowledge where I could start buying on Manheim. And they, at first, I remember they would only let me look through, what was that, like really cumbersome one? It had like the worst user experience. It took you like 3.5 hours to find a car that two hours later you found out you didn't want. But I mean, that was the era of car buying, is like you basically had to attend the Manheim online thing, or you had to, but the more important thing with the DC area was, how do you get rid of vehicles? Mm-hmm. So like, do you use the local wholesaler? Do you pay the freight to go to Manheim, PA? The decision tree was, you would send kind of the better wholesale trades to Manheim, PA. You would send the junk with high miles to the auction west of Dulles. And then that auction was notorious for exporting vehicles to South America and Africa and the Middle East. Hmm. So like through the whole Syrian civil war, when like a car would pop up and may have stickers from various Northern Virginia car dealerships that were like all made fun of on CNN and stuff, they were all like, the joke between all of us is that they were like coming out of that one auction right by Dulles Airport.
So how do you use data? Like, how do you, I mean, obviously everybody uses Viato, but you know, if you stock 350 cars at any given time, that's no small feat. I mean, and how do you know which cars are going to move? Are you kind of, is this just really an art and not a science?
At that time, you'd line it up on Viato. There'd be profitability rules baked in that were determined by the general manager. So, you know, I suppose like they'd pencil in a $2,500 profit after PAC and, you know, RO. So maybe they'd put a arbitrary line item for PAC. It's discretionary among all honored dealership owners. And then there'd maybe a line item for a $1,500 RO. And then, you know, the general manager would go buying like crazy, and then we would appraise trade-ins, and then we would always visit all the trade-ins from the next day in a manager's meeting. And the point was to call them back and offer them a little bit more, because ultimately we put our hands on that vehicle. We could understand that vehicle. It was like a bit more of a sure thing. Mm-hmm. But the general manager like existed like the oracle of the store.
Sure.
You'd walk back and you'd beg for more money on a trade to make a deal so that he'd bump the ACV. You know, I love like the magic of dealership accounting, where like ACV is as good as gold and like one person gets to determine that. But like, it was always a game working the general manager to get a bump on the ACV to go out there and make the deal, because times were different back then. Front ends were thin.
Did you guys have different rules, like, you know, on trades that you got rid of everything over 100,000 miles or over 10 years old, or that if a car was sitting for like, you know, on day 91, you're selling that car, it doesn't matter what you're selling it for?
That was something that we often got criticized for, was not holding onto vehicles with like 120,000, 130,000 miles. Ultimately, we were trying to get vehicles that banks could finance for us and the customers around us would buy. Northern Virginia is relatively high income due to the government employees. I guess everybody there makes at least $120,000. So like, therefore, you know, the certified Toyotas and kind of like the mid-range Toyotas did really well. And we would certify almost everything unless it didn't make sense. And that would be like a 2% fringe. So we really loved certifying Toyota vehicles, for mostly for the finance outcome, or like the reliability of spotting a deal, knowing that the bank would stand behind you.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And then as you did you end up running the whole store?
No, I ended up going out to Easton Toyota for that. It was like my experience to do that, which is the Eastern Shore of Maryland where I grew up. So after the seizure, Mr. Coons kind of like sent me there. And that was like my foray into doing that, which was neat. It was a smaller store and got to see everybody from high school, and it was cool.
Let's talk a little bit about that. I'm curious, you know, as you ran the whole store, what you learned on the new car side, you know, and then, you know, you kind of get to see all the pieces together and how they all, how everything worked together, what things you came in to change or keep the same. I'd love to go into that.
Yeah. So like, and to clarify, I worked with JT Thompson there. So JT was like ultimately the general manager, but I would work as like a GSM, and in lieu of JT, we're kind of like one for one. So JT and I kind of like ran the store together.
Yeah.
So what I learned, it was like very peculiar going from a very large store with like every resource under the sun to moving to the Eastern Shore of Maryland, which is split by the Chesapeake Bay. So you're going to like a rural area that people really only pass through to go to Ocean City, Maryland. And then otherwise there's kind of like a small rural town, but those, I grew up there. That's like a weird part about me is I'm from there.
Yeah.
So like I can speak that language. And, you know, it like vehicle shippers would not cross the Chesapeake Bay Bridge to drop cars off for us. So like, that was really interesting. I started having to go to like Delaware to buy vehicles so that I would get the straight shot over. I'd have to forge relationships with wholesalers. We didn't have a reliable relationship with a, what's it called? Body shop. Mm-hmm. So I found this, like, I persuaded this, Persian guy I knew from Tyson's Toyota to like come over once a week. And we would like, what would we do? We'd set up plastic, like it was a murder scene on Dexter. And this guy was like a mobile body shop and he would work magic. And I just talked to him last week. He's still there doing it. That was the best, like, random find of my life. It was just like the world's greatest mobile body shop guy. And then we would have, I don't know, 130 new cars in stock. We would stock about 70 used cars. And, you know, it was great. I loved it. And we were like, what did I bring there was kind of like the mentality of Tyson's Toyota, which is kind of to my own detriment. Like, we were a small store. We were supposed to be kind of sleepy back then. And that year, like my first year there, we were like the number one growth store by units in Central Atlantic Toyota. So that's like 150 stores. And like our profit was up. Our profit was up per car. But like, did my employees like that? I don't know. Like maybe not. Because Easton's kind of a place for like crabbers and watermen and guys who want to like go hit happy hour at 5 o'clock. And I think I brought like a touch too much of like the DC, like let's go. And they may not have been ready for that, but like, I loved my time there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, would you change that?
No, I mean, I would say like how the challenge with being on the Eastern Shore of Maryland is like, how do you recruit the very best people?
Yeah.
How do you get, and the way I sell it is you get to have a boat and you get to live on the Eastern Shore and you get to make good money. And there's a store, you know, if you look at this map, like in the middle between Delaware and Maryland, in the middle of nowhere, called Preston Ford, it's in a field. And they outsell every Ford store in Baltimore and DC. So that guy's name's Dave Wilson. Mm-hmm. So like Dave is running a giant operation from a cornfield in the middle of like center Preston, Maryland. Yeah. So like, I've always been kind of like impressed by Dave and kind of motivated by Dave as, you know, an entrepreneur from my hometown. But, he was always kind of like the high watermark for me. So like Dave was doing it, therefore I could do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously very different experience going from a really big store down to a much smaller store. And even at that scale is still a pretty, you know, decent sized big store comparatively. Right.
Yeah.
What do you think, like, what did you really take from the large store down to the smaller store besides obviously the attitude and sort of what the work ethic, that's not to say that people weren't working hard there, but just the attitude and Tell me about that, because I think that there's a lot of folks who we've had on and who will end up listening to this that are at some of these smaller stores where they have to be a little bit scrappier, and they just don't have all the resources that a really big store like a Kuhn's store does.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a Kuhn's Toyota store, so it was like great store, like facing on Route 50, ideal location. We had like a ton of space, and then what I would say is like the fundamentals still work. So like just calling the phone ups the next day, your margin for error is a lot thinner. You have to get the right inventory. If you swing and miss at Tyson's Toyota, it doesn't really matter. Like, it will sell. I remember one time we bought like a orange Prius C at Tyson's Toyota, and it had a birthday on the showroom. And then we cut out the triangle eyes like a jack-o'-lantern and like put them on the car. And some like weirdo walked in that weekend and bought the car because of that. And that was always our crowning journey. But like, if you did that at Easton Toyota, you have no way out of that vehicle unless you want to take a $5,000 bath. But another thing at the Kuhn's group at the time is we had like a 60-day turn rule. So your pay plan was very contingent upon turning vehicles within 60 days. Mm-hmm. So again, if you had to write down three vehicles against your paycheck at a small store, you could get hurt. But at Tyson's Toyota, it was kind of like an inevitability. It was kind of like a riding line item. It'd be very, very rare if we ever cleared them all out. But at Easton Toyota, if you didn't clear them out, it could mean like $5,000 to $7,000 top line off your check. So like those kind of nuanced little things meant a lot to you, but the fundamentals still worked. I would say, like, if you get the opportunity to go to a small store, the opportunity is still the same. Monetarily, you can still make a lot of money. And then I think where you have an opportunity to really change the most is culture and recruitment. And how do you get the very best people to come to the small store? And how do you sell, like, the lifestyle and the community to them? Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, I was at Roorman Toyota last week, and they're not a small store, but, like, the vibes there and who they're recruiting, I think that was like my biggest takeaway of that story, is they were just recruiting great people.
Yeah. I really want to talk about recruiting because that's such an important thing. Tell me just really quickly, did you end up changing the pay plan? Was the pay plan the same? And did you just find that if the pay plan was the same, that people basically had to just be more careful?
That wasn't like dictated by me. You do negotiate your pay plan when you have like an executive role at a dealership where you get a percentage off of net. Sort of
everyday guys.
Yes. We would write the pay plans and we would try to be very strategic. I mean, I would say at Tyson's Toyota, we went through iterations of very complicated pay plans. Yeah. And I would say complicated pay plans with bonuses based off of this, this, and this are very hard to solve for in the long term. I think what you want with a pay plan is very simple. This is what you're getting paid either per car or per gross, you know, percent of gross or something like that. Maybe with like a units kicker to incentivize, you know, scale. Mm-hmm. But then solve for the short-term problems with like bonuses and contests. So, you know, I would use like the March Madness thing to like get rid of the aged units, or, you know, do the aggregate days in stock count. So like incentivize your people to sell the oldest vehicles in stock by like giving whoever sold the most days in stock by the end of the month, you know, $5,000, and the second place guy $3,000, or stuff like that. So I think pay plan takeaway for me is simplicity, nice and easy, but then so solve for the short-term problems with context.
Obviously, being
like
in a smaller town, it becomes harder. How do you find people? How do you find the right people? When do you let people go?
Yeah, no, that's the thing, because, you know, you can't just reliably at Tyson's Toyota, four people would walk in every day asking to work there. And you'd have a pick of the litter. And then out in Easton, you would have to recruit friends. You'd have to ask people if they knew anybody who'd want to come and work there. There were non-competes in Maryland. So you never wanted to be like caught poaching from another store. So you didn't really, I don't think we enforced non-competes, but I think our competitors in the area did, and we knew that. So like you didn't want to steal from other places. So it was a lot of kind of like using the people who worked there to ask their friends and, you know, perhaps giving people who were service advisors at certain places opportunities to come to the sales floor. That's kind of where we found fit. And then Easton is a cool spot to kind of slow your life down a little bit. So if you were a guy who was in Annapolis or Baltimore and you just kind of like hit the wall, you're like done with the city, you can just do the same thing in Easton and have like a little better life. I mean, it's fun, man. There's like water, and nothing that appeals to my wife, but like hunting, fishing,
by the way, I think there's
and all that stuff there.
Recently been a court ruling that those non-competes really can't be enforced anywhere, which is, yeah. California, they don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how about that?
Don't enforce.
There are certain states that like, and I think that's that now a big that's thing.
More of a nationwide thing, but so it's interesting. It's interesting. What about, I want to, you know, talk a little bit about service as well. Like, were there, did you spend a lot of time focused on service department and optimization, revenue optimization? And obviously we've talked about selling from the service lane, but tell me a little bit about that area.
I mean, staffing it was kind of like my primary concern. We always had either a service manager or a service director that could really bounce ideas off of. I mean, my primary interaction with service was they would come to me with an RO and they'd break my heart and they would tell me the car that I thought I bought so well actually needs, you know, a new headliner. I remember one time I bought a 4Runner I was like so proud of, and like a family of rats had been living in the headliner. Or, you know, and it was like basically a totaled vehicle. So, you know, it, that was a lot of kind of like the finesse and the keeping a positive relationship with your service director while you would kind of have to discretionarily work repair orders. And what do you do with brakes when they're this reading? What do you do with tires when they're this reading? You still need to make profit, da 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 da. But there's also standards you have to uphold. What do you do with PDR? But in terms of service, I never really touched pricing because Kunz had like a central service director that was really useful for that sort of thing. Didn't really have to touch the tech stack. Kunz had a management company. That, they were like extremely useful. So I would help in terms of staffing or in terms of finding them people, doing interviews and stuff like that. But I wasn't too day-to-day.
I'm here. And so I want to jump ahead to Car Dealership Guy, which is sort of the... I would say is sort of the shining light, the really golden child, glowing beacon of what everybody looks to in the space now. It's been such an interesting rise from, you know, I met Yossi when he was still not public about who he was, and when really his presence was kind of on the up and up, and it's been such a fun thing to watch him build, and obviously you're now such a key part of helping him build that. What's it like sort of being at, you know, you could say one of the fastest growing companies, certainly media brands for the space? What are you guys seeing, and what's the experience?
Yeah, I've had so much fun. I mean, it is like such an opportunity to test creativity and turn kind of like an on-the-fly idea into a business. You know, all the credit goes to Yossi for creating an insight-driven social media account that really found product market fit at scale. And then I reached out to him, and the truth is that Yossi and I had a ton of parallel thinking. I filled up his anonymous LinkedIn inbox. I had no idea who he was. I gave away the farm with like every idea I ever had. And he kind of replied, hey, here's what I have. And, you know, to a certain extent, they matched up very similarly. So Yossi and I had a very similar idea on what we could do here. And I remember early conversations was, hey man, this is a media company. And I said, I know it is, but there's these kind of like ancillary things that come with it. So step one was kind of creating products, creating a reliable and replicable way to go to market, and then finding a way to you know, prep guests for the podcast, book guests for the podcast, find a way to create the newsletter, find a way to publish the newsletter in the best possible way, and then starting to find staff around us. And I know that Yossi's CEO or COO from his previous company came on with us as a CFO or COO. So suddenly we had a guy who kind of like could review contracts and make sure that Yossi and I weren't like moving too fast and all these things. So it was really a great resource to have. And then we needed help with, you know, creative and, you know, making thumbnails and all these things. We brought on Cole as a creative director. So like this thing suddenly was growing pretty fast and we were making advertising deals and we were promoting things for brand partners and just having a ton of fun. I mean, you remember when Yossi did the identity reveal at NADA and we had that documentary play at the cars.com booth? That was like such an electric moment in all of our lives. There was a lot riding on it. And I know everybody always says to us like, oh, you made such a mistake not being anonymous anymore. But I mean, we were in kind of like a war room in the weeks leading up to that, because a lot of people were hitting us up with like, hey, I know who you are. And that was getting weird. So we were kind of like, hey, you can handle this on your own terms when you have a great story to tell. And I was really glad that Yossi did that. And then we got him together with a buddy of mine who put together that little like mini documentary, and he knocked it out of the park. And what are we seeing at Car Dealership Guy is like, I think what excites me the most is finding product market fit for creators. And, you know, this business is, it's so addicting. You know, we signed that guy, Russ Flips Whips, and it was, you know, Russ got some brand deals and Russ got some nice promotion opportunities, but what he's built is exceptional. And he's a creator with us now. And, you know, Russ and I went to Roarman and we like trained their staff. So Russ and I developed a in-store training thing. Like we kind of came up with it together. Then we called Roarman and we're like, hey, we got an idea. And they were like, all right, cool. And it was about how you can build a social media following as a car salesman and leverage it to sell more cars. And Russ, the way his mind works, it's not what you think it is. It's like very prescriptive and there's steps to this. And there's certain videos you can make to grow a following. And there's certain videos you can make to, you know, that are lower funnel that'll get you leads. And he was so smart. And the way he explained it, he sat behind a salesperson there named Dalton who didn't have TikTok. And he sat behind Dalton like Steven Spielberg was like, literally like, this is how you download TikTok. This is what you say. This is what you do. Stand in front of the new Land Cruiser because it's interesting. And he does it. And Dalton's first video got 70,000 views. And like the second one got 60,000. And then the owner called me a week and a half ago. He's like, dude, Dalton got 350,000 views on one of these last night. And then the next day he got a 1 million view video. So like Russ and I kind of, that's another thing. It's like you get to iterate these ideas and we bring them to the market and they hit. And even the job board is something that we were kind of like offhandedly talking about and it hit and people really like it. So Car Dealership Guy is ultimately a media company, but we help creators find product market fit. We're really good at spinning up kind of like the businesses around them, so like the dealership training or kind of the
Car Dealership Guy. What are the next 2, 3, 5 years look like?
I know two internal initiatives we have that are like really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, they're non-competitive with anybody, but just kind of like an offering that'll be like totally different. So we've got two internal products that we'll probably launch. They're not like a dealership vendor or any way or something like that. But so like all the powers that be will kind of put our heads together and put something out there. We'll continue to sign creators because that's the ultimate goal here is like insight. And then with Russ, I think it's like even entertainment. So, you know, you want to bring people that appeal to dealers and OEMs and, you know, the vendor economy, consumers. I always say like Car Dealership Guy's most important audience are the dealers and speaking to stakeholders at the dealers, but also employees at the dealers. And then, you know, I would say the other people that matter a ton to us are the manufacturers, the vendors, consumers that follow us. They kind of, it's not like they're along for the ride, but they almost follow for like the palace intrigue of how the hell does a car dealership work. They like to understand why does the used car manager hold on to my keys, that sort of stuff. So yeah, I mean, we are growing. There's a deliberate growth plan.
Well, it's been really fun.
Ultimately, it's just a large media
company. I know that, you know, you guys had me on the podcast, which was a lot of fun for us, and the reception was, it was honestly overwhelming. So it's very clear how engaged dealers are, and it's super exciting what you guys are building. I'm just thrilled for you and for what you guys are doing, and excited to follow along in the progress. And we really appreciate your time. So thanks for coming on, and thanks for all the fun stories and insights.
Thanks, Nate. I feel the same way about the Lasso. I think you guys are a great way to buy a car. And like, had I had you as a resource back in the day, I absolutely would have used it. Like, it's just a lot easier to handle it.
All right. Well, thanks again. And thanks for joining. And we'll be back next week with another episode. Thanks.